Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Tom Hartman is a progressive national and internationally syndicated talk show host heard by over 2.75 million listeners weekly and simulcast. Yeah. He is also simulcast on television in more than 40 million homes. Talkers Magazine named Tom as the eighth most important talk show host in America for the past 3 years, and for three of the past 5 years as the number one most important progressive host. He is the New York Times best-selling, four-time Project Censored award-winning author of 24 books translated into 17 languages. We are delighted that Tom has returned to the Tattered Cover tonight to present his latest, The Crash of 2016. Would you please join me now in making Tom feel welcome?
Thank you. Thank you so much. Great to see you all here tonight, and thank you so much for showing up. Thank you to Charles and to Marty, wherever Marty went, for putting this venue together, for making this thing happen. Special thanks to the Tattered Cover, of course, you know, of Charles and Marty, and to AM 760 and the great folks at Colorado's Progressive Voice. Dan Mandis and all the folks involved there, and Gloria Neal in the morning, Glow in the morning. It was great being on her show this morning. And thanks to Lisa Maxson, who helped me get around and navigate around the city. There she is over there. Thank you, Lisa. Really appreciate it. So I start the book out. In fact, it's okay if I just grab one. Okay, thank you.
No.
You can't have that book. I start the book out with a story that I remember from when I was maybe, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years old, something like that. I was a science fiction junkie as a kid. And every month, the Amazing Stories used to come. My dad subscribed to it, and you know, John Campbell edited it. And people like Jack Vance and Robert Anderson, Paul Anderson and Robert Silverberg, they wrote these great stories for it. And I remember this one story. I've not been able to find it because this is long before the days of the internet. But this is my memory of the story. And I opened the book with this. If I was 8 years old, this was probably 1959, so it was probably around that time. And it was before we had sent men around the moon. In fact, it was before anybody had gone into outer space. I think it was before John Glenn. But in the story, which takes place in the future, they had shot this space capsule up, and they were going to circle the moon and then come back to Earth and tell us all about what was on the backside of the moon, because everybody was just like, you know, what's on the backside of the moon, right? What if there's a crashed spaceship there, right? What if it's, like, volcanic? What if it's, what if there's ice? What if there are cities? What if there are people, little green men? Who knows? You know, we're going to find out what's on the backside of the moon, because only the front side of the moon has ever faced humanity. And so as the capsule is going around the backside, around the front to the side, toward the backside of the moon, the guys in the space capsule, you know, tell Dallas, you know, get ready for losing radio connection because the moon, of course, is going to block the radio waves. And so they turn off the radio and, you know, get ready to. And as they're coming around the back, there's this long, horrible pause as they're looking out the window. And then, in my recollection, almost a fist fight breaks out over, shall we tell them? You know, shall we tell them? Because, and ultimately they decided not to, because the backside of the moon, remember the old, what do you call those things that go up and down so fast that you get in? roller coasters. Thank you. The old roller coasters that are made out of 2x4, you know, on 2x4, you know how they used to do them. Well, the backside of the moon was this scaffolding of 2x4s holding up this giant canvas, which was the front of the moon. And it was like, you know, we can't tell people this, you know. Part of it was they'll think we're crazy. Part of it was they think we're lying. Part of it, they'll institutionalize it, us. And part of it was, you know, humanity isn't ready for this. Well, in a very real way, that's a perfect metaphor for our economy. We had in the United States from the late 1930s, certainly the 1940s, through the 50s, through the 60s, through the 70s, into the early 80s, we had the strongest, most powerful, most healthy economy that the world had ever seen. We also had the fastest growing middle class and the wealthiest middle class that the world had ever seen. The world had never seen anything like it. We had four consecutive decades of growth, GDP growth that exceeded 3.2%. Never happened before, never happened since. This is just, it was absolutely amazing. And it was done very intentionally. It was done with some very, very real and very rational economic policies. There was a time, I remember this. In fact, I couldn't go back and find that old Amazing Stories, because to buy a collection of 1958 Amazing Stories, and maybe it was 59 and maybe it was 60, and I just couldn't do that much eBay and that much reading. But I did have Sam Sachs, who helped edit this book and worked a lot on it with me, was my producer for the TV show, and I begged Sam if he would just go through. We bought, and I knew it was, I was pretty sure it was 1966 Time Magazine. And so I bought on eBay a whole year's worth and said, would you please, Sam, you know. And he went through and he found it. He actually found it. And in Time Magazine, there was an article about how the question of the article, the title of the article was something like, you know, the coming leisure society, or what will we do with our spare time? And the article correctly pointed out that from the time of the George Washington administration until the time of 1966, when this was published in Time Magazine, that as productivity went up, wages went up. They always followed each other. I mean, there were a few little hiccups along the way, Civil War and things like that, but basically productivity and wages always followed each other. Productivity is a fancy way of saying what people make, what people do, the consequence, the outcome of their work. And, you know, we had a couple of bursts of productivity, Eli Whitney and the cotton gin in 1835, the building of the railroads and the Industrial Revolution in the 1860s through the 1880s, the American industrialization, big-time industrialization in the 1930s. There was a big boost during World War II, although that didn't have there wasn't a wage associated with that because it was the war effort. But in any case, these two lines always followed each other. And in fact, I mean, literally from the George Washington administration to the Reagan administration. And on page 77 of the book, those of you who have the book, you'll see this graph. And this doesn't go all the way back to George Washington. It starts in 1947. But you see there's two lines here. And then right about the time of the Reagan administration, these two lines split. The top line is productivity. The bottom line is wages. Wages have flattened out. So when productivity goes up, a couple of things happen. One, more stuff gets made, which means that there's more profit for the company. And two, the company's making more money, and so typically they pay more wages. I mean, this is how it's always been until the big change in the Reagan administration. Now, that gap in between there represents two things. There's one side of it and there's another side of what it means. And on the one hand, what it meant for the people who were the owners of our society was that as productivity went up, profits went up. Today, right now, as we speak, corporate profits are higher than they have ever been in the history of the world, higher than they've ever been in the history of the United States, higher than they've ever been in the history of any country, higher than they were in the history of the Roman Republic, the Greek Empire, you know, you name it. Corporate profits are higher than they've ever been. The income of the top 1/100th of 1% is higher than it has ever been in history. Stock market hit a new high, 16,000, just a couple days ago. So, and, you know, 80% of stocks are owned by 20%, the wealthiest 20% of people, and the remainder that are owned are owned by, you know, things like pension funds and things like that. I mean, the occasional 401k, but it's not, most people don't have that much money in the stock market. So basically what we're looking at is that canvas front of the moon. You know, it's the rich person's economy that seems to be doing so well. And it actually is doing well. Rich people are just doing mind-bogglingly well. Since 2008, over 100% of all wage growth has gone to the top 1%. Over 100%, which means for the other 99%, wages have actually gone down. In fact, that's the one side, okay? So the rich are doing really well. That increase in productivity, that giant gap, all of that, it represents money. And all that money has gone to that top 1%. And when Time, let me pause for just a second, and we'll get to the second half of this and just get back to Time magazine. In Time magazine's story, they said, you know, if we look at the history of productivity and wages, as productivity really, I mean, there was a big burst of productivity in the late 1800s, and we went from literally the 70-hour work week to the 60-hour work week on average. I mean, you go back to the 1830s, 1840s, there were, you know, the 100-hour work week. This was for working people. And then in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900, we went to the 60-hour work week, and the progressives really pushed really hard in the 19-aughts and teens. We got the 50-hour work week, and then the 40-hour work week in the 1930s. And so they said, you know, what we've seen is not only have wages gone up, but the amount of work, the amount of hours people work has gone down. And so in 1966, the average wage was around, well, actually, I can read it to you. This is Time magazine. This is on page 79. And, oh no, this is page 77, excuse me. And what they said was, you know, that because productivity is going to continue to increase, because, hey, computers are coming along, you know, we got these big giant computers, you put these punch cards in them and magical things happen. And this was 66, right? And robots are coming along because everything's going to become more productive. People are going to have more time and they're going to have more income. So, quoting Time magazine, by 2000, the machines will be producing so much that everyone in the U.S. will, in effect, be independently wealthy. With government benefits, even non-working families will have, by one estimate, an annual income of $30,000 to $40,000. How to use leisure meaningfully will be a major problem. And let me add, $30,000 to $40,000 in 1966 dollars is $199,000 to $260,000 in 2010 dollars. So what happened, you know? I mean, who stole the Jetsons, right? Remember Spacely Sprockets? Back in the 60s, there was this cartoon. Some of you are old enough to remember, and some of you have seen the reruns on Nick at Night or whatever it is, you know, where George Jetson, you know, was a single wage earner family, and George went to work at Spacely Sprockets every day, and every 2 hours or so, he had to get up out of his chair and push that button. That was his job, right? That, tough work, but somebody's got to do it. And he made enough money that his wife, Jane, could have that credit card and go, charge, you know, and you know, that their kids could have a nice life, and, you know, that was in 1966 what they thought 2000 would be like. And had those two lines followed each other, it probably would be. I mean, not quite necessarily with Spacely Sprockets, but you get the point. Instead, I mean, just since 2008, we've lost 700,000 people from the American middle class. We've lost tens of millions of people from the American middle class since Reaganomics came into being, since Ronald Reagan first became president. So where did that go? What happened? Well, you know, first of all, it went to the top 100th and 1/10th and 1% of us, in part. Much of it went to transnational corporations, which moved it offshore, took it outside the United States. GE last year did more business outside the United States than inside the United States. People say, but aren't these companies killing themselves by destroying the American middle class? I mean, they need customers, don't they? You would think. Well, back in the 1960s, they did. And we had protective tariffs. The average tariff in 1966 was 31% on imported goods. So we still made things in America, because if you made them overseas, you had to pay a tax when you imported them. We didn't have these crazy free trade deals. And but now, frankly, these big transnational corporations, they don't give a rat's ass about us. I mean, that's, you know, pardon my French, but that's really the case. They don't care. I spent the month of November 1986 in Beijing, China. I was living at the Beijing International Acupuncture Hospital studying acupuncture. And the tallest building in the town in Beijing was the Hilton Hotel, which was 10 stories. You could stand, and I did, stand out in front of Tiananmen Square. There's this big, you know, 8-lane highway and maybe an ocean of black bicycles, and maybe once every 5 minutes a car would go by. I mean, that was China. There was no middle class in China at that time. Three or four days ago, the Financial Times had an article where they're estimating now, conservatively, keep in mind the population of the United States is what, 320 million, 330 million, something like that, whatever it is. Conservatively, that the middle class in China is over 300 million people now. So these companies, they're looking at the middle class in America going, oh, they can't buy anything anymore. So what? And I mean, it's very, you know, we'll just pen another Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership and start selling to those folks. I mean, you know, we don't need the American middle class anymore. And that is, you know, very much what has happened. So how have we maintained the appearance of the middle class? I mean, you drive down a suburban street and it looks the same as it did 30 years ago. It's a car in the driveway, there's a house, there's window shades, and people go to work in the morning. Well, you can't tell a difference just by looking at them. You can't, you know, back when Reagan came into office, the average home equity in the United States was $86,000. You know, now it's, well, it depends on what part of the country you're talking about and which year you're talking about, because we've had some real wild swings over the past few years. But it's radically lower than that. Let's leave it at that. And in the African-American community, it's below $5,000. In the white community, there are estimates of anywhere from $15,000 to $35,000, average home equity. This was the story of my dad's generation. You know, my dad, he joined the Army to go off and fight World War II, and then while he was in boot camp, World War II ended. So they sent him off to Japan for 2 years, and he came back, and on the GI Bill, he went to college, and he wanted to get his PhD and be a history professor. And in the middle of that, he met my mom, and they fell in love, and she got pregnant, and that was me, and my dad had to drop out of college and went to work in a steel mill and ultimately got a job in a tool and die shop, where for 40 years he worked in a union shop. He did the bookkeeping and on behalf of an amnesty owner, a little 14-man shop. But he also knew how to run half the machines in there. But he had that union wage. And he raised myself and my three younger brothers. He bought a house in 1956 for $16,000 on a 3% mortgage that was guaranteed by the government. He had gone to college for not just for free, but he'd been paid to go to college. He only went for 2 years, but he had done so. By the time he died in 2006, his house had been long paid off. He had a pension. He had health insurance until the day he died, and in fact, until the day my mom died several years later. His health insurance rolled over to her. His pension rolled over to her. I mean, the machinist unit took good care of Dad. And that was, and he had, you know, the house, the equity in the house, and he had all this whole huge antique collection, and he had 20,000 books in the basement that he had collected. And he was very proud of the fact that he had read most of them. That's what my parents did every night before they went to bed. They didn't watch TV. They laid in bed and read for 2-3 hours every night and turned me into a reading junkie. But anyhow, that was the economy. So if you drove down the streets back then, what you saw was, oh, that house has got $80,000 equity. That one has $300,000 equity. That has $150,000. And Dad bought a new car every 3 years, brand new car. And it was paid off by the end of 3 years. And then he'd turn it in as a used car and buy a brand new car. It never even occurred to him to rent a car. When I was in my 30s and I asked him about leasing cars, he laughed. He said, what, crazy? You know, I mean, a car was a form of equity. And he said, if you really want to do it smart, buy a car 1 year old, because then it's major depreciated. And then you've got an asset, you know, that, well, anyhow, you don't need me to go to the whole open. But the point is that nowadays you drive down that same street, and what are you seeing? You're seeing a house that's $20,000 underwater, a house that's $50,000 underwater, a house that has maybe $5,000 in equity. You know, you're seeing a completely different thing. You just can't see it from the street. You're seeing the cars in the driveways that are not owned, that are rented, that are leased. And if somebody, you know, misses a payment or loses their job, the car is gone. And so the first thing that happened, how did Americans fill in that gap? Right? Because wages remained flat. Wages in 1966, average individual wage was around $25,000 in today's dollars. Right now it's around $25,000 in today's dollars. It's been flat for 34 years. Whereas, of course, the income of the top 1% has just exploded. But what did Americans do to maintain their standard of living? First, mom went to work. Back in 1966, it was by and large single wage earner families. It was typically dad. Sometimes it was mom. But, you know, mom went to work. So women went into the workforce. And that was applauded originally as, you know, hey, this is a great thing, the birth control pill, the women's liberation, all that sort of thing. And, you know, I have no objection to that. It's a fine thing. Although I do think there is something to be said for kids not coming home to an empty home. But in any case, mom went to work. That was in the 70s. That was the 80s. That was through the Reagan era. That wasn't enough. So by the 90s, people, you know, even with two incomes, it wasn't enough. And because today, average household income is around $44,000, which means that you got, you know, two people working pretty much full-time and one of them maybe working two part-time jobs, whatever it may be. And it's interesting to hear, you know, you watch these econ shows and they go, oh, you know, average household income in 1966 was $25,000 a year. Today it's $40,000 a year. What are they complaining about? Well, that's household income. Back then, household was one wage earner. Now it's two, sometimes three. You know, you have to look at individual wage earners' incomes. So anyhow, mom went to work. The second thing, when that wasn't enough, was, okay, let's take the equity out of the house. Let's get a home equity mortgage. Let's, you know, we'll use that to live on. We'll use that to go on vacation. And it became addictive, especially as home values seemed to increase. Then when homes got tapped out, people turned to their credit cards. Now, I remember I started a business in 1972 that when I was 21. And that by 1975, I think was the year, I was making more money than my dad. And it was like that was a big deal, you know, both for him and for me. And we had this little company. We were making herbal teas. Mo Siegel eventually ate our lunch, you know, celestial seasonings. But we were doing pretty good. And I remember two things about that are of consequence. One has to do with taxes, which actually I'll get to a little later. But the other is the credit card. I had never had a credit card. I had never been able to get a credit card. And it wasn't until my income beat my dad's income that American Express issued a credit card to me. And, you know, I still have it. You know, it says member since 1976. And it's like, you know, wow, I was 25 years old. And that's what it took. Well, not now. So now people's houses are tapped out. And back then, nobody had credit card debt. In fact, American Express required you to pay your card off 100% at the end of the month, period. No discussion, not negotiable. And if you didn't, you lost your card, and it'd take you years to get it back. And so, in any case, now the average household in America has $27,000 worth of credit card debt. That's insane. That's insane. I mean, just the interest on that. So our houses have been wiped out. Our credit cards have been wiped out. And they said, well, what else can we steal from the American working people? How about their kids' future? When I went to college, and I know that they'll offer my apologies to you, a lot of this sounds like, oh, that was a youngin', you know. But the fact of the matter is I've lived to see this, and this is something that I think is a useful story. When I went to college, I went to Lansing Community College and Michigan State University. I didn't graduate from either one. Got kicked out of one and got arrested in a demonstration and kicked out of the other. But, you know. My claim to fame, yeah. I got tear gassed on Grand River Avenue protesting the war. Anyway, but the point is that I was able to put myself through college, to the extent that I did, working as a DJ part-time on the weekends on at WITL, AM/FM, Lansing, Michigan, playing country music. I was on various days of the week, I was the dishwasher, the short order cook, and the one day that the waitresses went out on strike, I was the waiter at Bob's Big Boy on Trowbridge Road in East Lansing. And, I mean, these were all, not all at the same time. These were different times over the course of a couple of years. And I worked at the Exxon station across the street from Bob's Big Boy, pumping gas and filling tires and replacing brake pads and replacing tires that had gone out. And with that little income, I put myself through college. I mean, I left home when I was 16 years old, as did my wife, and neither one of us ever took another penny from our parents. And in fact, Louise, my wife, actually put herself through college, and she did it working as a waitress in Howard Johnson's. And she drove her bicycle from Howard Johnson's to school. And she was not working, you know, 100 hours a week. And basically, back then, it was just tips. So what has happened? Well, interestingly, in the late 60s when we were going to college, 80% of the tuition of colleges, roughly 80, it was actually around 83% of the total tuition of colleges, of the total cost of college, was paid for by state governments, federal governments, or the colleges themselves. A lot of this was, Michigan State University, for example, was set up by Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln created the land-grant colleges, and what he did was he, over 50 of them, and he gave each one of them enough land that they could work that land and make enough money that they could run the college for free. They were free colleges. My mom went to MSU and graduated magna cum laude back in the 40s. And she did that, and she was broke. Her father died when she was 13 years old. Her mother was the city clerk for Charlevoix, Michigan, which was not that well a paying job. And mom went to MSU, and she paid for it by working summers in Charlevoix as a lifeguard. I mean, that's all it took. And then on the weekends, occasionally, she'd go out to the Lansing Airport and wash planes and prop planes. But that was it. You could go to college. Nobody knew what student debt was. I didn't know anybody who had student debt. Well, I knew one guy. He was working on his master's degree in math. He had borrowed money for his graduate degree. And if you really were, you know, if you really didn't even want to work that part-time job at Bob's Big Boy, you could go out to California and go to college for free, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, until Reagan changed that. So first they tapped out our houses. First they put us all to work. And I would say really did some serious harm to our families. And even our kids, they put to work now in many cases. Second, they said, okay, you know, cough up all that money you got in your house. Third, how about the car? We'll take the car. Fourth, you know, the credit card. Fifth, we want your kids' future. We have $1 trillion in student debt right now in the United States. This has never been seen anywhere in any other country on earth. The other developed countries of the world look at us and go, are these people crazy? And they're right. We are. Right? We are. And we need to declare a jubilee and just say, you know, that is our intellectual infrastructure. It should have been paid for with tax dollars, just like our physical infrastructure, like our roads and bridges. We're going to wipe out all that student debt, and that's it. Jubilee. So, which raises a couple of questions. Number one, why did this happen? Number two, how did this happen? And number three, why do we even have economies? The reason that we have an economy, the purpose of an economy, is to provide for the good of society, fundamentally. I mean, that's why, you know, governments are created to protect the commons, we the people. Read the preamble to the Constitution. There's not a word in there about, so some guy can get rich. Doesn't say it, right? Instead, it's all about you know, basically the commons, and the just simple, straightforward stuff of justice and domestic tranquility and the general welfare, the common defense. This is the commons, the things that we own collectively together, the things that we do collectively together. And one part of that is providing for an economy. So if you want to start a business, you get all kinds of special privileges for starting a business, but you have to get permission to start that business. You have to go to the state Secretary of State's office and file incorporation papers. And there's certain obligations that come with that. Used to be they were quite substantial until the 1890s. That's another book I wrote called Unequal Protection. But nowadays, not so much. But anyhow, it used to be it pretty much everybody understood, and I'd say pretty much everybody understood right up until the Reagan presidency, that the purpose of an economy was to make sure that everybody had a shot, that the American dream was not to be Bill Gates or to start Facebook. That was not the American dream. The American dream was the life that my dad had. And it was throughout the history of America, was to have a good, decent life, you know, work a reasonable job that you cared about or you enjoyed, raise your family, leave something behind so that the next generation's better than you were, and be proud of the life you lived when you die. And that should be the American dream. And somehow it got twisted. So why and how? Here's the why. In 1951, a fellow by the name of Russell Kirk wrote a book called The Conservative Mind. And in The Conservative Mind, Russell Kirk, it's the Bible of the modern-day conservative movement. His first chapter is about Sir Edmund Burke, who was the most famous conservative of the Revolutionary era. He was British. And Burke, one of his most famous quotes is words to the effect of, he thought only people of a certain class should be allowed to vote, right? He said, it does me no harm if a man is allowed to engage in a profession as servile as that of hairdresser or tallow maker, candle maker, but it does society considerable violence if such a man is allowed to participate in governance. So there was this notion that, and like I said, Russell Kirk devotes his entire first chapter to Sir Edmund Burke and that philosophy. There's this notion that if the American middle class ever got big enough and wealthy enough, that they would get fearless enough that it would produce social chaos. And this was the prediction that Kirk made in 1951, that if the American middle class continues growing at the rate it was in the 50s, that we would see social chaos. Now, back in the 1770s, we were having the same debate. It was the debate between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. And John Adams was of the opinion, he referred to working people as the rabble. And he was of the opinion that any kind of social upheaval, any kind of social ferment was a bad thing. This is the conservative worldview. It may be right, it may be wrong. I have my own opinion on that, but it's a legitimate worldview that stability is the highest value. And that's the traditionally conservative worldview that Russell Kirk put forward. And he said, you know, it's look out, basically. And it's the same thing that John Adams said. You know, we don't want this to happen. Now, Thomas Jefferson's rebuttal to that was every generation there should be a revolution. Not a shooting revolution, but there should be a rebooting. In fact, he said, and I quote, if this avenue of periodic revolution be shut to the call of sufferance, in other words, to the voters, to the people, it will make itself heard through that of force, and we shall go on, as other nations are doing, in the endless cycle of oppression, rebellion, reformation, and oppression, rebellion, reformation, again and again, and so on forever. In other words, you know, it's important to allow those changes and to actually embrace those changes. Jefferson, in many regards, was a progressive, and Adams was clearly the conservative of the time. So Russell Kirk warned about this. So in 1971, two things happened. One, it was sort of the great confluence. In 1971, you had... Actually, let me back up a little bit here. No, I'll get to that in a second. In 1971, you had the Lewis Powell... Well, in fact, let me back up a little bit from that. A couple years earlier, I think it was 66, 67, Rachel Carlson wrote Silent Spring. And it was a book about how DDT, they were just discovering, not only to kill insects, but it also made birds' eggs so thin, the calcium in the shells, that most of the chicks didn't survive. And she said, if we keep spraying DDT, and I remember as a little kid, the planes literally flying over Lansing and spraying DDT for mosquito control. She said, if we keep doing this, one spring, there's going to be no birds and no bees. It's going to be a silent spring. And Americans were horrified. And suddenly, the chemical industry was under assault. 2 years later, Ralph Nader wrote Unsafe at Any Speed. And suddenly, General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, et cetera, they were under assault. So that was happening. That was in the late 60s. Then when the Vietnam War was going on, you had young people saying, this was the fulfillment of Russell Kirk's prophecy, right? Was you're going to see revolt. You had young people saying, hell no, I'm not going to go off to Vietnam. You had African Americans saying, hey, what about that promise? You know, I thought we figured all this back out in 1860. You had gay people, Stonewall, I believe was 71. You had gay riots, literally, gay people saying, what about us? You had women who were saying, you know, burning bras, saying, you know, we demand equality, not just in the workplace, but right across the board. You had virtually every sector of society saying, what about me? I want those privileges that the old white guys have. And, of course, you know, Russell Kirk and all the other old white guys, William F. Buckley and Barry Goldwater and Dwight Ever Dirksen and whatnot, they were in shock. Cities were burning in 1971. So Lewis Powell was this lawyer in Virginia whose principal clients were tobacco companies, but he basically did law work for the wealthy. Very genteel. I think of Lewis Powell as a decent man. I spent a lot of time inside his head researching for this book and was quite surprised by what I discovered because I was expecting to find a villain. But Lewis Powell was seeing this America melting down, kids being tear gassed in the streets, cities, Detroit burning, you know, the divorce rate exploding, women demanding rights in the workplace, gay people coming out and having even parades and things. And he was looking at all this and he was going, oh my God. And then on top of that, most importantly from his point of view, not only is America falling apart, but our industry, which is what makes America great and strong, our industry is under attack. Rachel Carlson has ignited this environmental movement. Ralph Nader has ignited this consumer movement. And they're taking us on. So he wrote a memo in 1971 to his friend and next-door neighbor, or close neighbor, Eugene Sindor, who at the time was the president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, pointing out that historically business in America had not been political. Really hadn't. They didn't support candidates. They didn't, you know, they pretty much business just did business. And he said, we've got to, you know, we are under siege, his phrase. We are under siege. And we've got to fight back. We've got to, you know, the prevailing worldview in America now is that business is bad, is that business needs to be controlled, is that business needs to be stopped, is that business needs to be regulated. This will be destructive for business, and ultimately it will be destructive for America, because business is what drives America. You know, what's good for General Motors is good for America. You could call it the road to hell is paved with good intentions, if you wanted. So he said, what we have to do is we have to get the pro-business point of view out there, which has now become basically the pro-billionaire point of view. We have to get that out there, although I really don't think Powell was thinking in those terms at the time. We have to get that out here, and here's some specific ways to do it. We need to capture public opinion, number one. So we create think tanks. And out of this came the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. Out of this came the Charles Koch Foundation, which is today renamed as the Cato Institute. Out of this came the Heritage Foundation. Out of this came the Economic Policy, not the Economic Policy. Anyhow, there's a whole bunch of them. You run across the names of them. All these think tanks emerged in the late 70s, early 80s as a consequence of the Powell Amendment. So we need to influence public opinion. We need to scream loudly when liberal things are said in the press. Brent Bozell took that and ran with that, you know, with his accuracy in media or whatever it was. We need to seize control of the courts. The courts are ruling against us. So the Federalist Society was formed. And let's start indoctrinating in our law schools and, you know, in our judges. More than half of all judges now in the United States are Federalist Society members. The Federalist Society, very, very conservative organization, and they've basically taken over most of the law schools in America, to a large extent. And we need to take the courts. We need to take we need to take politics itself. We need to be supporting politicians who will work with us. We need to figure out ways to channel our energies into these politicians. We need to take over our schools. We need to change the textbooks from elementary school all the way to college. And now you've got the Koch brothers and others who are funding university professors and giving money to colleges saying, we will only give you this money if you teach this particular way, typically in business and economics school. And then they'll let you have an art class. They don't really care, that kind of thing. And that memo kicked off the counter-revolution to the revolution that Russell Kirk had predicted, the progressive revolution that was in the midst of happening in America in the 1970s. It kicked off that counter-revolution. And the first high priest of that was Ronald Reagan. He was the first person who got elected who was just absolutely right down the line in concordance with the Powell memo. And, you know, step by step, it happened. And, the first thing that happened, and so this is why. Now, the how. The first thing that was done, and this is why I'm calling this the crash of 2016, because we've seen these cycles over and over again in American history. In fact, let me just pause and talk about the cycles for a second, and then we'll get back to how, you know, what they did. Arnold Toynbee is said to have said, I've been looking for a year now for the original quote and can't find it, but there's a lot of people who quote him saying it, so, you know, maybe it's apocryphal. But anyhow, he is said to have said, when the last man who remembers the horrors of the last great war dies, the next great war becomes inevitable. In other words, you know, it's a variation on what Sir Edmund Burke said, you know, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. In 1920, Warren Harding ran for president of the United States on a platform of, and this was his campaign slogan, more business in government, less government in business. In other words, privatize the functions of government and deregulate everything. And he did. When he came in 1921, he massively deregulated it. There wasn't that much regulation to begin with at that time, but he dialed back regulations like crazy, and he cut the top marginal tax rate. The tax rate after you make about $3 million a year, cut it from 91% down to 25%, just like that. It set off a boom. All this hot money came in. People previously, business people, and I'll tell you two stories about when I ran that business in 1975. The second one was in 75 or 76, we had a CPA, and our CPA came to Terry and I, my business partner, and said, you guys are taking too much money out of this company. And I'm like, you know, hey, I'm having a good time. And, you know, we had the Volvo, we had the, you know. And he said, no, seriously, he said, you're hitting, you know, 40, 45, 50% tax bracket. And that's crazy for you to be giving that much money to the federal government. He said, instead, you should be reinvesting in the company. He said, you should come out with a new line of products or expand what you have or do some more advertising or you know, improve the quality of your products. You'll get the money eventually. Don't worry. You know, you build a company and you'll get the money. Or when you sell the company, you'll get the money and you can take it as capital gains and you can spread that out over a few years. But you won't be paying 50% income tax on it if you do it this way. Instead, you'll be paying, you know, 20 or 30% like you were a couple of years earlier. And so we did. I dialed back my paycheck, and we hired 7 more people, as I recall, over the next year and a half. So that's what people were doing up until 1920. Businesses were strong and stable. And so Warren Harding drops the top tax rate from 95% down to 91% down to 25%. And all of a sudden, all these CEOs and business owners are saying, hey, give me the money, right? And what do you do with money that's like lottery money, right, that's not dear, that you really didn't have to struggle to get? You gamble with it, of course. And so we had this speculative bubble in real estate that, I mean, literally you had real estate prices in Florida and California and parts of New York that were doubling every 2-3 weeks in some cases. I mean, it was just insane. Properties in Florida that had sold for $12 were selling for $15,000, you know, over the course of about 6 years. And then, of course, you had the stock market bubble, too. the stock market went from, you know, 50 to 360 or whatever, something like that. It's just, you know, doubling over a 9-year period. Just this explosion because of all this hot money. Working people were not doing any better. People talk about the Roaring Twenties and everybody assumes everybody was having a great time and they were flappers and all that. No. Working people were struggling. Working people were fighting. Working people were trying to have strikes and they were being killed by their employers. But the rich, it was the time of Great Gatsby. Right? The rich were doing fine. And then, of course, came the crash in 1929. And one of the first things Roosevelt did, Franklin Roosevelt, is he took that top tax rate back up to 90%. And from that point until the mid-1980s, average CEO pay in the United States was 30 times average worker pay. Why? Because it's crazy to take all that much money out if you're just going to pay it in taxes. Reagan then dropped the top tax rate in 1980. Well, the big one was 86. The first one was 83, dropped it down to 50%, and then in 86 he took it down to 28%. And guess what happened? Boom! Money starts flowing in, and we've had an economy with three identifiable bubbles now. All right, there was the real estate bubble that just burst. Before that, it was the tech bubble, and before that, it was a stock bubble, basically. A stock bubble and a bubble in the S&L industry, which Reagan had deregulated in 83. And, of course, it blew up in 86, which is what happens when you deregulate banks. The banksters go wild. So, you know, to his credit, Reagan not only investigated over 1,000 people, sent over 600 to prison, Charles Keating and buddies, but he also re-regulated the S&Ls, learned from his lesson. We haven't been so fortunate this time. And it's not for lack of trying. The Obama administration has certainly been trying. The Bush administration had no interest in doing these things. So, number one, Warren Harding dropped the top tax rate. Reagan dropped the top tax rate, and no president has raised it. So we still have an economy that's built on bubbles and hot money. Number two, deregulation. Harding deregulated the banking industry. In 1935, maybe it was 34, I used to know Gloria Swanson. She was an old friend. She was on the board of a community for abused kids that my wife Louise and I started in 78. And she'd been a vegetarian since 1929. And we ran a vegetarian program. And she was on our board and lent her name to what we did. And I used to go to New York every 6 months or so and just spend the evening with Gloria in her apartment. We cooked dinner for each other and tell tall tales about old times, you know, and her and me and Louise. And she told me these wild stories about Joe Kennedy, who she really hated. He had been her manager, and he kind of ripped her off. And anyway, but she said, and I've read this in other places. I mean, she might not have heard it from Joe. She might have just thought she did. But she said that Joe told her that when FDR put him in charge of the very first Securities and Exchange Commission, he said, "Joe, I'm doing this because it takes a crook to catch a crook." And, you know, so in 1935, we re-regulated the banks, and we re-regulated the investment industry. In the 90s, there was this thing called Enron. And Enron, Ken Lay, desperately wanted to trade in commodities futures. He just so wanted to trade in commodities futures. It was making him crazy, in energy futures. But, first of all, energy wasn't a commodity that you could trade. I mean, the reason why you have futures markets, a little lesson about futures markets. I'm a farmer, you're bakers, right? And I'm going to grow a crop this year, and I don't know if it's going to be a good year or a bad year. Are we going to have too much rain, not enough rain, just right? If it's a good year, I'm going to do well. If it's a bad year, I'm going to get screwed. You're, on the other hand, bakers. You need a certain amount of wheat, and you know you need a certain amount of wheat. And you know that if I have a really good year, the price of wheat is going to go down. If I have a really bad year, the price of wheat is going to go really very, very far up. And that's not going to be good for you as bakers to have that kind of volatility in your pricing. So we make a deal. I will contract to sell you half my crop. I'm going to take I'm going to gamble the weather on half. The other half I'm going to nail down with this deal that I'm going to make with you so that we both have some stability and safety. I'll sell you half my crop in advance for a fixed price. You'll know that, you know, at least half the cost of running your bakery has already been determined. It's on your balance sheet. You can budget. And same thing for me as a farmer. That's why we have futures markets. And in futures markets, typically, you have the person who produces and the person who consumes. They're called counterparties. And futures markets typically were only for counterparties. They were for the producers and the consumers. And whether it was pork bellies, which would be made into bacon, or whether it was oil, and you'd have the airlines buying oil futures and the gas refiners buying oil futures, or whether it was wheat or whether it was soybeans or cotton, they were always physical commodities. Well, energy wasn't a physical commodity. So Ken Lay thought he could make a whole pile of money on betting on futures, which typically people didn't do. Typically, it was only counterparties who participated. And it was all regulated through the Chicago Board of Trade. It was all these trades were transparent. Everybody could see them. And there were regulators. So he wanted to get rid of the regulators. Well, the chief federal regulator for this was a woman named Wendy Graham. Wendy Graham was the head of the Commodities Trading Futures Board, whatever it was called, during the Clinton administration. And she changed the rules so that energy could be traded. And then a few months later, she left her job with the federal government and went to work as a member of the board of directors of Enron. This was not enough for Ken Lay. Ken Lay had this Ponzi scheme going, or a variation on it. He had over 800 companies. He was putting all his profits into one company, all his losses into other companies. He was taking money in stock from the profitable company. He was shifting the unprofitable company. He was hiding them, basically. And the banks were starting to figure it out. And if the banks figured it out, it would all come unraveled. So he wanted to be able to own his own bank, and he wanted that bank to be able to not just be a checkbook bank, but also to be an investment bank that he could use to gamble in commodity futures. The Glass-Steagall Act, though, said from 1935 forward that it was illegal for those two kinds of banks to be in one institution. You had your checkbook bank, where you got your mortgage and where you had your savings account and your checking account. They're called commercial banks. And you had your gambling bank. It's called investment banks. You had Merrill Lynch or Fidelity or whatever, you know. And they didn't do banking. In fact, you couldn't even have a checkbook for a long time from a lot of these places. They were brokerage houses. These were two separate things. So Ken Lay desperately wanted these two to merge, do away with Glass-Steagall, so that he could get his own bank and he could gamble with it. And he wanted to be able to gamble on commodity, on energy futures in a way that had never been seen before on Earth. Ken Lay was the smartest guy in the room. They made the movie, and the smartest guy's in the room, right? And he had this idea. And his idea was, okay, we do a counterparty trade, right? Like with the wheat. We'll use the wheat as example, although he was doing it with energy. So let's say that the value of our trade, I'm offering to sell you $100,000 worth of wheat for your bakery, and you guarantee that you're going to buy it from me for $100,000, and that's our deal. So we've got a swap. We've got a futures contract here that's worth $100,000. What if you could place a bet on that as to whether it would go up or down? In other words, which party would win? Whether you guys would end up on the better end of it or me? It's going to depend on what kind of season I have, right? So you place a bet on either side, and let's say you bet $100,000 on it, and then, or $200,000, and then somebody else comes along and says, "Okay, there's a bet on whether or not that derivative trade is going to, or that future trade is going to go south. I'll bet $500,000 on that $200,000 bet that $200,000 bet is going to lose." Just on that, right? I'll bet $500,000 on that. So then somebody else comes along and says, "I'll bet $1,000,000 that your $500,000 bet is going to go bad or stay good." And somebody else comes along and says, "I'll bet $10,000,000 on your $1,000,000 bet." And it goes like, right, like this. This was Ken Lay's brilliant idea. And, you know, as I mentioned, Wendy Graham was on his board of directors. Her husband was Phil Graham, the Republican senator from Texas. Phil Graham, in 1990 and 2000, introduced two pieces of legislation. One was Graham-Leach-Bliley, which blew up Glass-Steagall and allowed Ken Lay to have his bank. And the second was called the Commodities Futures Modernization Act, which said that you don't have to actually be counterparties to a trade. You can trade in anything. And, in fact, the trading doesn't even have to go through a regulated exchange like the Chicago Board of Trade. Now, here's some numbers that will blow your mind. The total gross domestic product, all economic activity in the United States, the total GDP of the United States is around $15 trillion. That's everything. Purchases, sales, wages, bank account, everything. The GDP of the entire planet is $65 trillion. Trillion is 1,000 billion, right? $65 trillion, the entire planet. Before Phil Gramm's legislation, there was virtually no such thing as a derivative. A derivative, by the way, is one of these bets that has at the very, very bottom, when you unwind it, some actual thing of value, in this case the wheat that we're talking about, and from that value is derived all these bets, thus called the derivative. So Ken Lay said, well, let's do derivatives with cool stuff like energy. Well, he didn't really have much of a chance to do that. Enron failed. But the banksters figured out that they could do the same thing with mortgages. Because you can't drive down, I mean, you drive through farmland and you can see who's got the corn in the silo and who doesn't, right? You know how much oil is out there. You know how many pork bellies there are. But nobody knows whose home is mortgaged and who isn't, and how badly and how much. So let's take these mortgages and bundle them into 1,000 mortgage packages, slice them up into little pieces, sell those off, and then start selling bets on bets on bets, okay? You with me so far? The value of this is called the derivatives market, and it's an unregulated market, a gray market. It's done by a bunch of guys in a townhouse in New York, in Manhattan, right, by and large. And this is no regulated exchange, no oversight. According to the Bank of International Settlements in 2008, the value of the unregulated derivatives market was $800 trillion. The GDP of the entire planet is $65 trillion. And every time these guys bet another $1 trillion, they'd pull $1 billion off in commission, which is why last year there were 12 people on Wall Street who made over $2 billion each, and they're still doing it. Now, when it blew up back in 2008, that $800 trillion, some said nine, that $800 trillion went down to around $500 trillion. It's back up now to almost $800 trillion. So another story I tell in the book is the story of Joe Stack. Joe Stack was a small businessman. He wasn't making it. It wasn't working. And he had not deducted his taxes and paid them, and the IRS was coming after him, and one day he just snapped, set his house on fire, went out to the airport. He was a small private pilot, got in his little Cherokee Piper airplane in Dallas, and flew right into the side, the 10th floor of a glass building. He knew that that was the floor where the IRS offices were, killed a very decent civil servant who was sitting there along with himself, America's first suicide bomber. I would submit to you that Joe Stack, the Occupy movement, the Tea Party, at least on the ground, not the $300,000 buses that the Koch brothers are bringing, you know, but the people who show up in good faith, that we all know something horrible is wrong here. Something has just gone horribly wrong. But people don't know what it is, and they don't know how to react to it, and so they react in different ways. But now we're seeing all these mass shootings, and I would say that many of these mass shootings are just suicides. The BBC did this study in 2003. Go home and Google it. BBC 2003 suicides, conservatives. And what they found was that this was a 100-year study from 1901 to 1999 of the United Kingdom and Australia. And what they found was that whenever conservatives took power in either of those countries, suicides went up. Whenever labor took power in either one of those countries, suicides went down. Because the middle class did better under labor, the wealthy did better under conservatives. And the last paragraph of the article, and this is not an op-ed, by the way, this was a straight-up reporting, looking at the numbers. The last paragraph of the article says, therefore, had conservatives never come to power in the United Kingdom or Australia, at least 35,000 people would not have committed suicide. I think we're seeing it right now. We're seeing this right now. So what do we do about this in the 5 minutes I have to wrap this thing up? What do we do about this? And why 2016? Why this crash? When Franklin Roosevelt came into office, when he first ran for office, he was running on a very kind of milquetoast platform. He was talking about balanced budgets and incremental change and slow and steady, just like Herbert Hoover had been for 3 years. But back in those days, the election was in November, and you didn't get sworn into office until March. And the week that he was sworn into office, every bank in America failed. And he had an Occupy movement on his hands. Back in World War I, the soldiers had been given a coupon worth $100, which is maybe $2,500, $3,000 in today's money. They'd been given a coupon worth $100, redeemable in 1940 as a bonus for their service in the military. And they were like, we're out of work. We want these bonus coupons to be converted now. We want our money now. And they were literally occupying from the front door of the White House all the way down to the Potomac River, all the way across the mall. I mean, there was tens of thousands of people. It's called the Bonus Army. So Roosevelt was confronted with an economy in free fall, the banking system collapsed, an Occupy movement that was not going away, and most importantly, a populace that for 3 years had heard Herbert Hoover say, all we have to do is wait for the rich people to start making jobs again. The job creators will do it. Don't worry, just wait. And by that point in time, the American people knew that that was a crock. And so Roosevelt not only won overwhelmingly, but the Democrats took the House and the Senate so overwhelmingly that he could basically do whatever he wanted. And the first thing he did is he said, the best welfare program is a job. We're going to put people back to work. And he started the WPA and the CCC. In the first 3 weeks of his administration, he had put 100,000 people to work. In the first month, he had put 1 million people to work. I mean, it just spread like a virus across America. People going back to work. And he dropped, he cut our employment, he more than cut in half the unemployment rate in the United States in his first 3 years. It was amazing what he did. But he was able to do that because the American people had figured out what the scam was and what had gone on. President Obama came into office in 2008, and we were in a very, very similar crash for the exact same reasons. Right, the deregulation, the tax cuts, the fill in the insane trade policies. I could go through the list. It's in the book. Exact same reason. But the American people didn't know that, right? They just knew, hey, you know, there's a bump in the road. It's a recession, right? 700,000 jobs a month. But it's a recession. Yeah. Nobody was willing to use the word depression. And so when Obama tried to fix it, and he made a serious effort, he was not successful. Because he only had a 13-week window there before Scott Brown got sworn in to replace Ted Kennedy. There was only 13 weeks out of his entire presidency when he had a filibuster-proof Senate. And he could actually pass something. And he passed the stimulus bill, and it stopped the bleeding. But we're still in the Depression. You know, the phrase Great Depression wasn't used until the first time it was used was in the 1940s to refer to the 1930s. In the 1930s, it was referred to as the panic, the recession, the crisis, you know. Great Depression was a word that came much later. We're going to refer to this time as the Great Depression. So my basic premise is that we are in a point of time right now, and I'm going to run 5 minutes over if that's okay. Thank you, Stan. We are in a point of time, or Charles, thank you. We're in a point of time where, A, the crash has not finished. And it's going to. It's like, you know, basically they're throwing bubblegum and baling wire at this thing. But until the structural changes are made, it's inevitable. And there is not the political capability. There might be the will. I mean, Elizabeth Warren, President Obama, Nancy Pelosi, there's people out there speaking about this. Bernie Sanders speaking about these things. But try and get it past the House or the Senate. It ain't happening. So it's going to take a crash to wake people up to do this. That's the bad news. And get ready, fasten your seatbelts, because it's going to be just like 2008, only it's going to be worse and it's going to last longer. Hopefully it'll resolve in a year or two. But it's going to have to be long enough for the American people to go, oh, now I get it, right, and demand those changes. The good news is that if you look at the history of crashes in the United States, out of every one came radical, dramatic, and positive progressive change. Crash of the 1935, maybe I already said this, but it bears repeating. The crash of 1935 brought about the New Deal. The crash of 1897 brought about all those progressive reforms. I did say that earlier, didn't I? I didn't go through that list. Okay, I did on the radio today then. The crash of 1897 brought about the 17th Amendment, the 19th Amendment, gave women the right to vote, you know, direct election of senators. The crash of 1857 led to the Civil War, which led to the end of slavery as an institution in the United States. The crash of 1770 led to the creation of the United States. It led to this massive act of civil disobedience and actually $1 million act of vandalism called the Boston Tea Party, because the Boston Tea Act of 1773 was not a tax increase. It was a tax cut. It was the biggest tax cut in the history of the world that the British government gave to the East India Company, most of whom, virtually everybody in Parliament and the House of Lords, were stockholders in the East India Company. They had 14 million tons of tea in stock that they couldn't sell, on which they had already paid taxes. So the 1773 Tea Act gave them this, what in today's dollars would be hundreds of billions of dollars tax cut, on, or tax refund, actually, on that tea, so that they were able to come into the United States and sell that tea under market prices and wipe out all these small entrepreneurs, all these little tea shops all up and down the East Coast. And those entrepreneurs said, to hell with that. And they dressed up like Indians, and they went on board that ship, and or those three ships, and threw that tea, 348 chests of tea, into the harbor, into the Boston Harbor. And then, of course, that led to the Boston Ports Act of 1774, which said that if Boston doesn't pay back the East India Company $1 million, we're going to close the port to commerce. They refused to pay. They closed the port. That led to the Boston Massacre. That led to the, you know, Concord and Lexington, and which led right to the American Civil or the American Revolution. So the good news is, I don't think we're going to have a violent revolution. I know that there's a few crazies out there in the woods who are, you know, stocking up on AR-14s and whatnot. But I think that what history shows us is that we will have a progressive revolution. Because we have to. Those fundamentals have to be put back into place. And America needs to be restored to the greatness it once was. And it can be. And our history, every bit of history we have, tells us that it will be. But it only will be if when that moment of political opportunity, when that gap opens, when that crack in reality for the average American opens and suddenly they realize that they didn't have any idea what was going on and now they've got it figured out, when that crack in reality opens, if enough of us are awake and aware and can step into it and speak out, and some of us run for political office and others of us be working the outside, you know, being the groups who are there, you know, cheering them on, making it happen and showing it up in the media and doing those things, then we can make America the great country it once was and even better. And that's the good news. And that means that you all play a role in it. So, Tag, you're it. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.